Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
When people talk about Christianity, they usually understand there's three major branches: Catholic, Protestant, and usually on this podcast or on Catholic Answers Live, you hear a lot about the differences between Catholics and Protestants. But there's one branch of the church, one branch of Christianity, that often gets left out of the discussion, and it shouldn't, because it encompasses a large number of people, and that would be Eastern Orthodoxy. Maybe you've never actually met someone who's Eastern Orthodox or never even seen an Eastern Orthodox church. In a lot of the world, it's very sparse or non-existent, but in other parts of the world, especially in Russia, in Eastern Europe, it is the dominant religion, the dominant Christian church. In fact, there's somewhere between 200 to 250 million Eastern Orthodox around the world. They're the second largest Christian communion behind the Catholic Church. So, how should we understand our Eastern Orthodox brethren, and how can we better restore unity between the Eastern and Western branches of the church? Here today to join me to tell us a little bit about that and help us understand Eastern Orthodoxy is Father Deacon Daniel Dozier, a Byzantine Catholic deacon and the chief learning officer for the Center of In-Ministry Development. He holds graduate degrees in leadership and scripture, is an associate professor of scripture at the St. Cyril Methodius Byzantine Catholic Seminary, and an academic associate in Catholic leadership at the Franciscan University of Steubenville. He is also a member of the United States Eastern Catholic Bishops Committee on Catechesis. He has a wife, children, and grandchildren, and he lives in the Pacific Northwest. Father Deacon, welcome to the Council of Trent podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Trent. This is wonderful.
Yeah, I'm glad you're able to stop by, and I love your new booklet, 20 Answers Eastern Catholicism. We have this 20 Answers series we've been putting out for a few years now here at Catholic Answers. I remember when it first started, I kind of wrote a third of the booklets, and then I think I officially retired from the 20 Answers series. When it went back, when it was like the first like 20, 25 booklets, I think I did like 8 or 9 of them, and then I'm like, I'm going to take a break from 20 Answers, and now my contributions are a smaller minority because we've covered so many topics, and we've gotten great people to write on them who have background that I think is important. And your background in the Byzantine Catholic Church, are you with the Eparchy of Phoenix?
I actually am with the Eparchy of Phoenix, yes.
Okay, but I mean, it's large. I mean, it covers a lot of geographic territory.
covers the whole swath of the western coast. It's about 13 states, including Hawaii. So it is, and for those who may not know, an eparchy is actually what in the Roman Church would be called, or the Latin Church would be called, a diocese. So it's our bishop is based in Phoenix, and yet he has jurisdiction over all these territories. So it's a rather large eparchy.
It certainly is. Yeah, I attend a Byzantine Catholic church here in San Diego, and I remember looking, there is, I don't know if it's published by the Eparchy or not, but it's a little magazine or newsletter called Light of the West. And I think it had a cover story about the Byzantine church finally reaching out to Hawaii. And my services are always available to do a mission or a speaking opportunity there. If you want to.
I think you might have to get in line. I think there's a long line of clergy as well. They can't wait to visit and do pastoral ministry among the sand crabs there. So it's pretty exciting.
Right. But your booklet covers Eastern Catholicism, but it also goes into Eastern Orthodoxy, which often overlap when people discuss these issues. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you've become interested in writing about these things? Because you also wrote a book on Eastern Orthodoxy, co-authored with Dave Armstrong, I believe.
That's correct. Yeah, Dave Armstrong, actually, this was the third edition of a book that he had written called Orthodoxy and Catholicism, a Comparison. And after going through a number of editions, he decided with the third edition, he wanted to have some Eastern voices, some Eastern Catholic voices in the new edition. So he invited me to do some co-authoring, and it was a great discussion, great dialogue, and a great collaboration as well. But my first association actually with the Eastern churches came in my college years. So when I was an undergraduate at Franciscan University, I was blessed to know a Melkite monk who lived nearby, who was encouraging me from time to time to, you know, expand my Latin Catholic horizons. And so, because I had been a Latin Catholic and was also interested in exploring more aspects of Christian spirituality, especially with the fathers. And so he said, well, why don't you go visit a Byzantine Catholic church? And there's one just down the road. So sure enough, I went. And it was actually the St. Thomas Sunday for that particular liturgy. So this is the liturgy after Pascha, or as it's sometimes known in the West as after Easter. And I remember just experiencing something that was very unique. And it resonated so much. In fact, I went to my friends and I said, you know, I've always believed in the resurrection. I just don't think I've ever experienced it that way before. And I knew in that moment that this was something I needed to explore further. And so over the course of a number of years and studies, and visits. My family and I, we ended up joining a local Byzantine Catholic church in the Midwest. And I was very committed to serving there in catechesis, as was my wife, was being trained by the deacon who unfortunately passed away a few months after my training. And then it was actually some 10 years after that I was ordained a deacon to serve in the church, and have been serving now for 11 years as a Byzantine deacon.
Oh, it's so wonderful to be able to hear. Now let's dive. And honestly, I felt the same thing. I started attending a Byzantine church during the Great Fast, which in the West would be called Lent. And that was actually helpful for our family. I think it was good to start our experience of attending a Byzantine church during the Great Fast, because that's when I think it's the liturgy of St. Basil, whichever liturgy it is, it's like an hour and a half or an hour and 40 minutes long.
That's right.
So it's like, well, if we can find our spiritual fulfillment and if we can make it through the Great Fast, it's like, oh, well, we can, especially the length of liturgy, it's more because we have children. We have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I'll tell you, they're better behaved in a long Byzantine liturgy than in actually a shorter Novus Ordo, because there's always just kind of a one continuous prayer or song or hymn, it feels like, going through the entire thing. And I agree with you, celebrating Pascha or celebrating Easter, just that glory of the resurrection just really shines through in every doxology, every hymn. Absolutely.
That's right. If you're not aware that Christ is risen from the dead, if you attend a Byzantine service at Pascha, you will know by the end of the service, because we sing it so many times. And you're right. I think one of the beauties, I think, of the East, and I think it's also of the West, but I think, you know, it is a distinctive of the East, especially with our iconography, is that there's so much there to really engage the whole person. Mm-hmm. So it's in the singing, it's in the incense, it's in the bells, it's in the icons, and all of that is meant to communicate the radiation or the radiating light of Christ, and that I think is something that speaks to all ages.
Now, before we get to Eastern Orthodox, let's catch up some of our listeners to give them a 101. What are the differences between Western and Eastern Catholic churches? Because many people think of Catholic Church, they only think of the Western or the Latin Rite. What are the Eastern Catholic churches, and how are they Catholic?
Sure. Well, I think in order to answer that question, we really have to think about the founding of the church. When Christ, obviously, his holy advent, he came to earth, he came to establish his kingdom, and it was one holy Catholic and apostolic church. And he established it on the foundation of the apostles, these men that he called to be his emissaries, to go out into all the world, to preach the gospel, to baptize in the name of the Holy Trinity, and so forth. And when we read that in Matthew 28, we have this sense that it's not just for one particular time or one particular place. It really is all the nations. And so God's intention originally for the church was that it would be a church of the nations. And so as the apostles fulfilled that commission after receiving the Holy Spirit at Pentecost, if we go to Acts chapter 2, verse 42, we see that the church in its common life is really expressed through four key elements. It's apostolic faith, so believing in the apostles' teaching. It's apostolic worship, sort of sharing in the sacred mysteries, as we call them in the East, of the sacraments. It's apostolic communion, so it's that common life among Christians, and then also apostolic leadership. So we are actually being shepherded and governed and sanctified and taught by people who are men who are successors to the apostles and bishops, priests, and deacons. So this model of apostolic faith, worship, leadership, and communion, that really forms the framework for the spread of the church around the different nations. And so as the apostles then went out, they established these churches that followed all these four elements. And as the gospel was planted over time, the people who became believers initially was mostly Jews in the diaspora, that is outside of Jerusalem. But as Gentile Christians came in, you started to see the same faith, worship, and common life expressed in unique ways according to the artistic, cultural, linguistic genius of that particular people. And we're talking here in terms of the establishment of churches, really churches around the Roman Empire, both the eastern side of the Roman Empire and the western side of the Roman Empire. And that really becomes the basis for what we understand today as Eastern Catholic churches and Western Catholic churches. And for many people, they're kind of surprised too when they hear, when we start talking about churches in the plural.
Right.
Because the Catholic Church is truly a church of churches made up of 24 self-governing churches, one Western church, which is that the Latin church as we know it, which is the largest of all and best known. And then we have these 23 self-governing churches that are really the heirs of all those wonderful churches planted by the apostles and their disciples over many generations.
And so I think this is helpful for us to understand that you have these churches that are planted, grow, and celebrate the faith in different ways, you know, in the West, celebrated in Latin, in the East, celebrated in Greek, or in other areas, in Aramaic or Syriac or Coptic. So lived out in different ways, but they're all still one church, because even these other 23 churches, they're still in union with Christ's one church and recognizing, for example, that the Bishop of Rome has the succession of the Apostle Peter.
Yes, exactly. And that, I think, is one of the aspects of being a church of the nations. So it's unity and diversity. It's like St. Maximus the Confessor talks about, you know, the church being the icon of the Holy Trinity, where you have unity and diversity all brought together. Just as in the Trinity, you know, one God, three persons, so we have all the different churches of God existing in unity and respecting the foundation, the Petrine foundation of the church, which is tied directly to the apostolic foundation. And so as they spread the gospel, it's the apostles all in union together under the headship of Peter, if you will, as the first among them. And that continues on in the church today.
Now, let's talk then how, when we have these Eastern Catholic churches who that have developed for hundreds of years, nearly 1,000 years, then most people are probably familiar with or they've heard of or could at least answer on a test when the quote-unquote Great Schism was, East and West split apart in 1054, though, of course, it's much more complex than that as any large historical event is. But most people understand there's the Eastern Catholic churches, then after 1054, oversimplified, of course, you have the Eastern Orthodox. How do these Eastern Catholic churches suddenly become something different, a different church that we now call the Eastern Orthodox?
Well, and in fact, if we think about the heritage of the Eastern churches, they are, in fact, Orthodox churches that are in communion, not just with Rome, but with each other too. So that's one of the things I appreciate and value in being an Eastern Catholic is that it's not just I'm in communion with other Byzantine Catholics, you know, of different stripes. It's that I'm, or that I'm just in communion with the Roman Church. It's that I'm in communion with Armenian Catholics, Coptic Catholics, Ethiopian Catholics, Syro-Malabar, Syro-Malankar, the whole wide array, the whole mosaic of Eastern and Western Catholicism. So the foundation of our churches are truly Orthodox. Now, what happened over time, and there were a variety of reasons. You mentioned the 1054 date, which is more of a symbolic date, as you allude to, than an actual date of rupture. But it really set the stage, I think, for that rupture, that eventual estrangement that took a couple of other centuries to really be ratified. And so as these churches began to separate, part of the separation occurred for a number of different reasons. One being linguistic. So, you know, where you have a separation of language, the Greek and the Latin. You know, at one point the whole empire spoke Greek, but now you have more of an emphasis in Latin in the West and Greek in the East. And so it's hard to speak. It's hard to talk to one another theologically in terms of the terminology and so forth. Also cultural differences, different political interests, ecclesiastical interests. You also have in the Byzantinese, which isn't oftentimes talked about from the perspective of Christian unity, but this 117-year period of iconoclasm that exists over two phases in the Byzantine Empire, where basically the Byzantine church was in heresy and out of communion with all of the other Catholic churches because of its embrace of iconoclasm, which was a teaching of the emperor. So the emperor was attempting to foist upon the church, believing himself to be like an apostle, a false teaching, which was to reject icons as heretical. And so as a result, there was this rupture in communion. It took a number of efforts and even some councils to rectify. But that did harm the union between East and West over that period. And in fact, it was one of the things that helped to precipitate the establishment of a new Roman emperor in Charlemagne. Mm-hmm. And so you have a division in the empires between East and West that also reflects a growing division among the churches. Now, of course, Byzantium became Orthodox again and became, you know, right-believing and once again in the communion of the Catholic Church. But that created some problems that were latent and then appeared later on, especially when you started to see, you know, the ascendancy of the emperor assuming a role that was really meant to be Petrine. Mm-hmm. And this imperial ecclesiology develops as a result of that. So this separation occurs. You have finally, a number of centuries later, the Council of Florence, and there's a recognition of Catholicity in both of the churches of the Latins and the churches of the Greeks, and yet there's also a recognition of rupture. So it's really viewed as an internal schism between two churches in as part of the one mystical body. And so there's a number of theological debates that occur and so forth, but as a result of you really not being able to come to agreement on some critical issues, even though the Orthodox patriarchs sign off on the union as part of Florence, they go back to their homelands and the people utterly reject it. And so they renounce the reunion council of Florence. And as a result of that, that's really where you see a formalization of the schism. And then finally, just to conclude here, the Eastern Catholic churches then were part of the fruit of the Council of Florence, where there was a desire. They saw, look, this union is possible. So we want to live in full communion with Rome and with all the different Catholic churches. So some Eastern Catholic churches, Eastern Orthodox churches, re-entered communion with Rome. And so you have a division then between not just between the Latin Church and the Eastern Orthodox churches, but between the Eastern Catholic churches and the Eastern Orthodox churches, even sometimes their own mother churches. So that's really where you see the development of the Eastern Catholic churches.
So just to summarize for our listeners, there are multiple causes that cause the East and the West to grow apart linguistically, geographically, politically, culturally, even theologically, when you had the emperor in the East proposing the iconoclast heresy, saying that you can't have graven images, you can't have icons, which of course icons are now a staple in Eastern yes. churches because God became incarnate, became man. He made himself an icon. And so we can represent him in that way. So you may hear the word, oh, this person is an iconoclast. It means someone who shatters an icon, you know, some we use lay as a countercultural reference, but that's what was happening there. Then we move forward and grown apart more, and especially in the 11th century, you have disputes. And I think you might be able to comment on this, that the problem is like the East and the West sometimes impose too much on one another without respecting the legitimate diversity that can exist within the Catholic churches. So, for example, there was a lot of controversy then about whether you could celebrate whether the Eucharist had to be celebrated with leavened bread or unleavened bread. Because in the East, you use leavened bread. It's risen, like the risen Christ. In the West, unleavened is what they used at Passover. And people worked themselves up into a tizzy. But now we see, well, that's that legitimate element of diversity that we can have.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. And those issues, it's not to say that those issues were not important. And so the Eastern Catholics said, oh, these aren't important. We're just going to ignore them. It's that they took a more irenic position relative to the differences and said, look, we can live together despite these differences because it doesn't necessarily call into question the essentials of our faith. Again, going back to the apostolic faith, worship, leadership, and so forth.
Let's talk about
the teaching of the fathers.
Right. Let's go to commonalities then before we talk about disagreements and then how to interact with our Eastern brethren, especially with the Eastern Orthodox brethren. Let's talk about what we share in common. We share so much in common that what you also spoke about earlier is to understand this is not separate ecclesial organizations or denominations like how we see Protestantism, because the Eastern Orthodox continue to have valid apostolic succession and valid orders. And so they're truly celebrating the Eucharist at an Eastern Orthodox divine liturgy. That is Christ's body, blood, soul, and divinity on the altar. Those priests are validly ordained. The problem here is you use the word schism, which refers more to like a recognition of authority rather than a difference in doctrine per se.
Yes, I think that's the fair distinction to make there, and I think it's an important one. So from the perspective, from the Catholic perspective, and you can reference this in magisterial teachings, both papal and conciliar, we view the Orthodox as true particular churches. So these are they have, as you say, a valid hierarchy, valid sacramental mysteries, valid apostolic succession. We have a shared faith on almost every critical point. We say really, truly every critical point, despite what some of the polemicists may see. So if you happen to go visit some Orthodox websites, sometimes there's this exaggerated false dichotomies that are presented as, you know, showing that there's essential differences between Orthodoxy and Catholicism in matters of apostolic belief, and it just isn't the case.
Well, let's dive into that some people, and I've seen this, some people will try to say there's these large differences between Eastern Orthodoxy and Catholicism, but I think sometimes they're just comparing Eastern Orthodoxy with Western Catholic theology, because that's why I believe that Eastern Catholic churches have a wonderful role in helping to build that unity between the Eastern Orthodox and the Catholic Church at large, because you could say, but wait, many of these differences, yeah, that might be different with Western Catholic theology, but if you look at genuine Eastern Catholic theology, it lines up pretty well with what you're saying is happening here in the Eastern Orthodox. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, because in fact, as I said, you know, we being Orthodox churches in full communion with the other churches in the Catholic world, this part of this aspect of our union is that we don't have to renounce anything that is truly distinctive and distinctively Eastern. Our goal is to be as fully Eastern and fully Catholic as we can be. And so, you know, if you look at our liturgies, if you look at our patristic sources, our common life in terms of how we're established. Now, there may be some differences, some accommodations. You know, if you're going to build a Church of the Nations, that means sometimes you got to compromise a little bit. We're the only ones really trying to do it.
Right.
And so there are some things that may differ, but in its essence, we're truly united. So, for instance, one of the points of controversy was at Florence and even somewhat prior to that. Was this use of the filioque.
Right.
This is the clause, and the Son, which is inserted into the creed of the Council of Nicaea Constantinople. And so this insertion of filioque.
It's the part where it says that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son, and the idea of the Holy Spirit proceeding from the Son was controversial.
Yes, that's correct. And so it was actually because it was inserted in a Western context and not as part of the effort of a particular council that the Orthodox didn't quite understand its origins. Of course, you know, we know historically it was developed in answer to Arianism and some distinctive pastoral situations that were going on in the West. And so, you know, as the creed later began to be added to the Western liturgy, it was the creed that included the filioque, whereas in the East, it had always just retained that creedal formula without that clause being added. And so, you know, as a result, you have this misunderstanding. Well, you know, you've changed the creed, you've changed the faith. When in fact, it, you know, as you go into the theology of it, it really isn't necessarily representing a change that is contrary to really even the Eastern tradition, so long as it's properly understood. Because within the Eastern tradition, there are aspects of the teachings of the Fathers, for instance, that seem to indicate what you might understand to be filioque, except it might be expressed as, instead of from the Father and the Son, it would be expressed as from the Father through the Son. And that's especially true among the Cappadocians.
Right. So that would just be an example, and the Catechism talks about this, that you can express this with different complementary language as long as the expressions don't become too rigid. Now, let's throw right. one more example before we get to kind of the heavy-duty stuff. I've also heard people say, well, Eastern Orthodox aren't like Catholics because Eastern Orthodox don't believe in original sin or the Immaculate Conception. And that seems to be another example of we do believe in these things, but it's different language. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And if I just might comment, I'm sorry, on the filioque piece, the one thing sure. I would say is that in the Byzantine churches, not this does not include the Maronites as Eastern Catholics, but in the Byzantine churches, the Greek churches, we do not include filioque in our liturgy. So we are, again, it's that example of unity and diversity.
And the Pope doesn't include it when he says Mass or Divine Liturgy with the Eastern Patriarchs.
That's correct. And in fact, the Latin Church in Greece does not include it in their creed out of respect for the setting that they're in. So, again, it's that diversity, that more Irenic approach that I think becomes very important because it's about charity.
Right.
It's truth and charity and unity. But coming back to your question about the your point about the original about original sin, which we sometimes refer to as the ancestral sin or the Immaculate Conception, again, these are examples where they've become wedge issues unnecessarily because, quite frankly, we don't want to understand each other. We want right. to stake out positions and be very polemical and create these false dichotomies. I've even heard people say it's been asserted that, well, we don't call Saint Augustine Saint Augustine. We call him Blessed Augustine because he taught all these heresies like original sin, which really is a rather cartoonish way of thinking about it.
In fact, the Orthodox would call him that?
Some of the Orthodox, and I've heard some Eastern Catholics who have sort of adopted some of this unwittingly, some of this polemic that is sometimes you find in, among the Orthodox. And you know, we were asked to return to our tradition, so we go to our sources, we go to the Orthodox, and sometimes we have to be discerning about, you know, what are we reading here? Is it truly our tradition, or is it more of someone's particular take on that tradition? But in this particular case, they're saying that it's Blessed Augustine. I talked to my good friend Father David Anderson, who was the protege of Father Alexander Schmaben, and he said, you know, they referred to him as Blessed Augustine as a superlative. So it was Blessed and Saint Augustine because he was so venerated among the Eastern Fathers, mm-hmm. Especially through his commentary in Scripture. So a lot of this is more of a modern rereading based upon some concerns that came out in the 20th century, especially around original sin, and it was not. It's a false dichotomy to where you're trying to say, "Hey, look, we're so different from the West because of this." And there were some problems with Augustine's view of original sin, but it wasn't to the extent that would make him a heretic. And the Church, I think, has corrected any problems or issues that might be. You see that especially in the Catechism,
right? Because the Catechism makes it very clear: original sin. Because I hear sometimes the East try to say that Catholics teach that in original sin we are guilty of the very same sin Adam committed, but the Catechism is very clear: original sin is not a sin of commission. It's a sin. It's a description of the deprivation of original justice and holiness that Adam and Eve could no longer pass on to us. That's something East and West should definitely be able to agree on.
Absolutely. And you even hear that echoed in the teachings of St. Simeon the New Theologian in his commentaries on Genesis, his catechesis on Genesis. He's very clear. He talks about this inheritance of guilt. But clearly, he doesn't mean the personal guilt of Adam. He means basically the state that humanity inherits, which is a state of corruption and death. And it's where we need to rely on Christ. We have original sin, and therefore, you know, we need Christ. If you read the whole baptismal liturgy, for instance, in the Byzantine right. tradition, we are moving from the kingdom of darkness to the kingdom of light. So all of us need to make that move, and we see that sacramentally in our liturgies.
And I think what's hard when you difference between East and West on this is sometimes in the West, definitely within Protestantism and maybe somewhat in Western theology, salvation is looked upon as being brought from guilt to innocence before God, especially yep. among Protestants, whereas in the East, we would probably say salvation is about being brought from death to life, especially life in God or theosis, being made partakers right. of the divine nature. And so here we can say, in a sense, we leave this guilt we've inherited and are made innocent and immaculate before God, but also brought from death to life. So it's complementary.
Yes, and in fact, we can think about death in a number of different ways. There's different types of death. So there's the death of the body and the separation of the soul, but then there's also the death of the soul, through a spiritual death. And so Christ, you know, through his resurrection, heals us of both types of death, because even personal choices of sin are themselves a choice of non-being. It's a choice of death. And I think that's another way to kind of appreciate, maybe right. a different emphasis in the East, but that is also complementary with the West.
Well, let's go to the biggest difference now, because I think if you have a dialogue between Eastern Orthodox and Catholics, even among Eastern Catholics and Eastern Orthodox, when we get past all of these issues, it seems like the biggest stumbling block, what's preventing unity, is an understanding of what the papacy is. So how would you yes. describe how the Eastern Orthodox view the papacy and what steps have been taken to try to build unity without compromising on this institution that God has given us?
Well, the root of our tradition is we have a shared tradition of Petrine primacy, where the understanding is, first of all, that Peter was the first among the apostles. And so in his exercise of ministry, he was to be the one commissioned by Christ to strengthen the brethren. I mean, this was his calling. He was to be the rock of faith. He was to be the guarantor of unity. In fact, the Church of Rome was regarded as the matrix of Christian unity. In the Apostolic See, where Peter gave his life in witness to the gospel through martyrdom along with Paul, the See of Peter and Paul became known as the Apostolic See. And it was the See to which all the other churches, so as the churches were built out by the apostles and founded, they began to develop in large metropolitan centers. We have what's called the Pentarchy, where you have, Rome being the first among the churches, and then you have Constantinople, which came later. Then you had Alexandria and Antioch and Jerusalem. Well, all of those churches have some Petrine association. So there is this sense that this unity is definitely Petrine in its foundation by the will of Christ. Peter obviously giving his martyrdom in Rome. You have in Constantinople, the brother of Peter, Andrew, is commemorated there as the patron. It was believed that he might have done some missionary work there. Mm-hmm. You had in Alexandria, Mark, the disciple of Peter. Antioch was actually the first see of Peter, right. where he served as its leading bishop or leading shepherd. And then Jerusalem, of course, where Peter preached first after Pentecost and thousands of souls were baptized and saved.
And issued a doctrinal declaration at the Council of Jerusalem.
And exactly. So all of these points show a Petrine connection, a Petrine and apostolic connection. So the Orthodox, in regarding the role of the Apostolic See and its leading bishop, who is the Bishop of Rome, see that C as the servant of unity in charity, the one who presides in love. Now, at the same time, one aspect of presiding in love doesn't just mean that, you know, oh, this is the church where you get a lot of affirmation and, right, people really like you there. It's no, to preside in love means that there has to be some aspect of governance, especially if you're going to serve as an appellate, in an appellate role, where, you know, if there's a conflict between the churches, as we saw with, for instance, with St. Athanasius, you know, where you have this dispute going on, and there were disputes, many disputes in the first millennium. Some people try to make it out as if, oh, it was just peace and everyone got along. It's like, no, that's not the history of the church at all. And to appeal to Rome meant that to arbitrate a decision meant that you had an authority that had to be above that of the people in dispute. And so for the Petrine role, they had some, there had to be an authority to decide between people who were in dispute.
Right.
And that arbitrator role was inherent in the role of the Bishop of Rome. So the Orthodox will recognize that. And that's an important stage. I mean, if you think about the Catholic reflection of the papacy, so much is contained in that understanding that we would accept, that would resonate with us.
Right. And I think the key is just moving along, because I've heard the Eastern Orthodox say, well, of course, Rome has a primacy. It's first among equals. But then there's not really any kind of recognition of an authority beyond the other bishops, not in a way that it makes the bishops not bishops anymore or like some kind of a tyrant, but a recognition of a legitimate authority. And because when you don't have that, one of the things I've noticed with the Orthodox, you lose unity. That some people think, yeah, the papacy is a source of division, but if you look at the Orthodox in the past 1,000 years, you've lost unity. The churches have become very nationalist, so much so that I think for any Orthodox, the identity is I'm a Greek Orthodox, I'm a Russian Orthodox, and that's what comes first. And so much so that the Orthodox really can't even get together to have ecumenical councils on par with what the Catholic Church is able to do, because someone's always able to kind of veto it, and things kind of remain this kind of stasis. That's at least my perspective.
Yeah, no, I think you're entirely correct, and this is where that imperial ecclesiology sometimes rears its head, where you have national churches, where even sometimes the church seems to function as an organ of the state.
Right.
And this is where, again, Petrine primacy, and Pope Benedict, the Pope Emeritus, he wrote quite extensively about this in terms of the service that the Petrine role can provide, which is to really rise above a lot of the nationalism and the disputes among the nations. Because if we're going to be a church among the nations, we have to find a way to live in peace.
Right.
Which means sometimes there has to be someone in charge, someone to decide when there are disputes. Now, in terms of the first among equals, I think there is a large degree of truth in that. If we consider the three levels of Petrine ministry, first, the Pope is the Bishop of Rome. He's the elected hierarch who leads the Diocese of Rome. So he has an actual diocese. He's a functioning bishop. So in that sense, yes, he is an equal to all the other hierarchs. There is no sacrament of the papacy. He is a bishop like all other bishops.
Right.
But then you take that next level, he's the patriarchal head of the Latin Church. Well, here he is the leading hierarch among the hierarchs of the Latin Church. And again, this is where you see that first among equals, where he is equal to all the other patriarchs. There's no one church that is better than the other. But it's in his role as successor of St. Peter, where you see more of a differentiation that I think is critical to understand, which is that role as the servant of unity, to strengthen the brethren, not to divide the brethren, not to impose Latin rules and norms and on other churches, but in service to that unity, to strengthen them in faith as well as in charity.
Right. And that phrase presides in love or over love, that goes back very early in the church. You go to the letter of St. Ignatius of Antioch to the Roman church. While he's correcting all the other letters of Ignatius, he's correcting all the other churches about errors they're falling into. With Rome, he just heaps praise and says that you preside, you're the church that presides over love, worthy of obtaining every desire, worthy of being deemed holy. And that verb to preside over, he also uses it in his other letters to refer to jurisdiction, to governance. That it's not just a mere affirmation; it's a legitimate authority. So let's, as unless you have a thought on that, I'd like to, as we draw to a close here, let's talk about some practical ways that Catholics can interact with Eastern Orthodox and help our Eastern Orthodox friends that we know come to appreciate the Catholic Church and just practical steps people can take in restoring unity.
Yeah, because I think that's it's such an important aspect of our role as Catholics. I think back to some of the papal magisterium and some of the teachings on evangelization. And I know Trent, you and I talked a little bit about, you know, we're not really talking about evangelizing the Orthodox. That's not really the intent here. In fact, what the intent is to restore Christian unity.
Right.
But I think there's some lessons in the, according to the teachings of the popes on evangelization that we can pull into our thoughts around building Christian unity, and namely among three different types of activities: witness, presence, and dialogue, which they see as part of evangelization. So if we want to build the Catholicity of the Church, we have to, first of all, be witnesses to unity and humility, truth and charity among the churches. So we do this, first of all, by not being condescending and triumphalistic in our approach.
Right.
You know, we're Catholic and we're here to help you. That's not going to win over anyone in terms of wanting to be in union with you, because to be quite honest, we've all inherited a history that none of us created, and so there's a lot of historical divisions and a lot of things to overcome. And our first posture should be wanting to be a witness to charity, to get to know people, to spend time with them, to appreciate their perspective. Much of dialogue, in fact, is about listening. It's also about learning, and it's also about communicating without compromising the essentials of what we believe and who we are. It's about communicating that in a way that generates understanding. So I think, you know, part of our witness when it comes to, you know, witness in truth and humility is to be who we are truly, whether it's Eastern Catholic or Latin Catholic, and yet at the same time understand that, you know, just as we have, you know, cousins or family members with whom we disagree, you know, you can imagine if there's a whole history and linguistic differences and so forth that develops, we want to enter into that conversation recognizing that there have been problems, and we need to be repentant of those problems, and at the same time say, look, what can we do to build bridges of unity? So I think that's an important part of what we need to do. Yeah. And I think I was going to say, when I've heard some Latin Catholics, when they come in, they come in very aggressively asserting Western practices as though they have this presumptive universalism, because it's in the Latin Church and it's part, you know, which is under the Pope. So they start talking about married priesthood in a way that's very condescending. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're talking to an Eastern Catholic or an Eastern Orthodox Christian about married priesthood, they're not just thinking about it in the abstract. They're thinking about Father Vasile. They're thinking about Father Mark. They're thinking about, you know, Pani Oresta. They're thinking about, you know, the husbands and wives, the priests and their wives who serve their communities and give of themselves. And so we have to be very cautious about assuming universality when, in fact, it may just be a particular tradition. So I think that's an important part of it.
Right. So I think to affirm that which is good and is a legitimate diversity, and then also once we do that and build a lot of common ground, then we can start talking about, okay, well, where do we disagree? Like, where's our legitimate disagreement here on the papacy? And then we can draw from things like Pope St. John Paul II's encyclical Ut Unum Sint, 1995 encyclical UT, UNUM, SINT. Definitely our listeners, look it up. You won't regret it. Ut Unum Sint on creating unity through the papacy. And then I think just being a witness, and especially this is where I think Eastern Catholics may have a special call from God when interacting in the same circles with Eastern Orthodox, that I think for an Eastern Orthodox who's considering unity with the Catholic Church, it's an easier step when the church you want to become unified with has the same liturgical practices, linguistic practices, almost the same theology that you can find in Byzantine or whichever it may be, Armenian, Syro-Malabar, Maronite, depending on the different churches that might be. And even in the Second Vatican Council, there was the document on the Eastern churches. It's Light of the East, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. It talks about that as well.
And the only thing I would also add to that is you can take advantage of opportunities to meet with Orthodox. There's a wonderful Orientale Lumen conference that meets every summer in Washington, D.C. My good friend, reader Jack Fiegel, helps to lead this. And we have Orthodox and Catholics coming together. This year, they're going to be talking about icons. Mm. So it should be a very intriguing time. So there are opportunities to come together and to appreciate and value some of those differences and have a dialogue with that in charity. So.
Okay. What are some resources? You'll get for the premium subscribers at trendhornpodcast.com for as little as $5 a month. You get all the bonus content. This week, I'll be sharing a few questions from 20 Answers Eastern Catholicism on Eastern Orthodoxy for our premium subscribers. Everyone else, it's a great booklet. I'd recommend 20 Answers Eastern Catholicism. Are there any other resources, Father Deacon, that you would recommend for people to learn more about Eastern Orthodoxy and how to restore unity there?
Yes, well, definitely the one you mentioned very graciously that Dave Armstrong wrote and that I helped to co-author, his Orthodoxy and Catholicism, A Comparison, I think is very good. Probably the best book, though, to really appreciate the Eastern spiritual path and some of the riches of that is the book The Face of God by Archbishop Joseph Raya, which to me is just one of the most beautiful presentations to help Latin Catholics, to help Western Christians really value and appreciate the East. And he speaks, in a way that is very accessible to the specialist as well as to the neophyte when it comes to Eastern Christian theology.
Very good. Another good book is by Aidan Nichols, Rome and the Eastern Churches, if you want also a historical look and from a top-notch theologian our listeners might appreciate. So, Father Deacon, thank you so much for joining us today on the Council of Trent podcast.
Thank you, Trent. It was wonderful.
All right. And listeners, I hope you got a lot out of this. And be sure to check out more episodes. Go to trenthornpodcast.com to become a premium subscriber. And consider leaving a review at iTunes or Google Play. And to check out our growing list of videos at the Council of Trent on our YouTube channel. Thank you all so much. And I hope that you guys all have a very blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.